there, my friends. Welcome to episode 52 of Yins Are Good, the podcast that shares and celebrates all of the good stuff going on out there and all of those good people who are making that good stuff happen. I am your host, Tressa Glover, and I'm so happy to have you listening in today, whatever day today might be for you. I hope that you're doing well, and I hope that you're carving out a little time to make a gratitude list that I talked about a couple episodes ago, a list of things that you're grateful for, of who you're grateful for, and if it is a who, maybe you can let them know. Tell them thank you. Send them a card, a letter. Oh, a letter. An old-fashioned letter. There was nothing like that, was there? Waiting for a handwritten letter in the mail. Oh my gosh. Because I think there's something that, you know, emails and texts, they're not the same. Because there's something about reading someone's words in their own hand. But I know that I want to thank you for tuning in again. And if this is your first time, then welcome. And I do hope that you'll continue to join us and maybe even share a story of your own. Moments of kindness that you experienced or that you witnessed. If you want to talk about someone who makes your life better. If you want to thank someone here on the show. Any and all of these things. And you get in touch with us by sending an email to yinsaregood@gmail.com. I actually have, it's really a moment of joy, a joyful moment that I witnessed the other day. So I was driving, it was around lunchtime, and driving through a neighborhood, and I hear a little boy, maybe 7 or 8 years old, and my windows were down, and I hear him say, "Grandma." And, you know, I look, I was at a red light. And the little boy and grandma were skipping down the sidewalk. And he was smiling, and she, from ear to ear, smiling, and they were laughing, and the two of them just skipping all the way down the block. And that made me smile. And what a really special moment. And what a cool grandma, by the way. And that's like I always talk about on the show when it comes to sharing moments with us and talking about moments you've experienced or witnessed. It's anything. Those what might be deemed to be small moments, right? Of joy, of happiness, of letting go, and grandma skipping down the sidewalk. And I think it's helpful that we share them all with each other. And we do our best to make each other smile and lift each other up. And speaking of lifting each other up, what is coming up in this episode today, you may be wondering? Okay, well, let's start with Name That Neighborhood. Now, I know this is going to disappoint some of you, but Don is once again absent from the Name That Neighborhood segment. Oh boy. No, he is, at the time of this recording, he is out of town. And we just couldn't sync it up to be able to do the segment in full like we do. But never fear. As you know, I do like the opportunity to change things up from time to time with this segment. So, I'm going to involve all of you this episode. And what we're doing is not Name That Neighborhood, but rather Where in the U.S. is Don DiGiulio? That's right. Don is in some city in the continental U.S. And I will be providing you all with statements of fact about that city. And then you'll have a chance to win some Yins Are Good swag. Yag swag, as I like to refer to it, which does not have a good ring. So we're going to come up with something else. So get ready for it. Also, please do get ready for our featured conversation. Oh my. So we talk a lot on this show about connecting with others and about finding commonality, especially through our stories. Well, there is a project that encompasses all of this and much more, and it's downtown right now. It's a 5-screen video installation, and it's called People We Love. It's the latest project from KMA, a UK-based creative collective. And the participants shown on the screens are everyday people who, in simplest terms, were asked to look at a picture of a person they love for several minutes and to be filmed while doing so. The project premiered in York Minster, UK, before making its North American premiere right here in Pittsburgh. How cool is that? The only place in North America that you can see this is right here in downtown Pittsburgh. So I heard about this project and that they were looking for Pittsburgh folks to participate. And I went to their website to learn more about it. And I read the artist statement from Kit Monkman, who is the creator slash curator, if you will, of the project. And part of his statement read, quote, "I find in all of these faces a silent affirmation of much that is best about being human, about the love that binds us, the stories that connect us, the light we create for ourselves, partly in acknowledgement and partly in defiance of the pain and suffering that accompanies us all." Well, I certainly signed up for it right on the spot. And so I went at my allotted time, with the picture of my loved one in hand, and everyone was so super nice. And well, that's all I'll say, because you'll hear more about it coming up. But it turns out that Kit Monkman was in town when I was there. And so I asked him if he'd be interested in coming on the show to talk about the project and his inspiration for it and et cetera, et cetera. And he said, "I'd be happy to." Hooray. And I'm just so grateful to have had the opportunity to speak with him about this and to be able to share it with all of you. And I do have to give a shout out and a thank you to Renee Pichocki, who is based here in Pittsburgh, for helping out with connecting me with Kit. I just love and am inspired and intrigued by this installation and what we can learn about ourselves and about each other and our connectedness. And I think you're going to want to run downtown, well, probably drive downtown, to see it, to experience it. So, I mean, let's not delay this any further, shall we? Let's get to all this good stuff. Kit Monkman is a leading and prolific innovator across screen-based art and interactive media. He directed the visually experimental UK feature Macbeth from 2018, which was described by chair of the International Shakespeare Association, Peter Holland, as, quote, "the most innovative rethinking of what it means to put Shakespeare on film for decades," end quote. He also co-directed Universal Pictures' The Knife That Killed Me from 2014. As a founder of KMA, Kit has also worked as an installation artist in the interactive public realm, creating works that have dramatically transformed many iconic spaces. Hello, Kit.
Hi.
It's nice to talk with you again. Thank you so much for chatting with me a bit about this.
Well, no, thank you. It's a real pleasure to be asked. And thank you for participating yesterday, which was great.
What I mean, it was such a unique experience. And, I didn't really know what to expect. Of course, a general idea, right? Of at least, okay, the process maybe of, okay, you're going to go in and look at a picture. But it was really moving in a way that, in ways that I maybe hadn't expected, or it was just really special.
Good. Well, I'm pleased you enjoyed, engaged with it and got something out of it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I am. I'm so excited to talk more with you about this and hear just, details of it. But can we start, if you could just start telling us a little bit about you, about yourself, your work as an artist, and KMA.
Yeah, sure. So I've been working kind of under the banner of KMA, which is sometimes me on my own, sometimes in association with colleagues. And I think I don't work under a kind of pseudonym, as it were, to hide my identity. I'm really proud of the work, and I'm proud to be associated with it. But it's more, I think, that the spirit of the work that I make as KMA is really all about collaboration. And often that collaboration is, as I say, with a fellow instigator, but almost always the collaboration is with an audience. And all the work really is about trying to explore how audiences become participants, and how, when they do, the boundary between the kind of artist maker and the participant becomes interestingly blurred. And so a lot of that work I've made has been interactive and digital. And People We Love is really the first attempt to try and take the spirit of interactivity and the spirit of participation into a entirely, well, I wouldn't say non-digital, because obviously it's using digital video, but a non-interactive form. So it's new territory for me. Having said that, I have made a couple of feature films along the way, which are experimental too, but which are kind of, despite being experimental, are certainly more traditional in form, in that they're 90-minute linear experiences. But I'm increasingly interested in this kind of, as I say, this porous relationship between maker, audience, and performer. It feels to me like a very 21st century project, in the sense that my argument is always that really before the printing press, human beings on the whole made art and told stories around campfires or the equivalents of. And in most of those instances, the kind of storytelling was digressive and collaborative. And so most of our ancestral history really is about working together on making stories come alive. And it's really only since the printing press and the kind of increasingly linear link between, an author who makes, when I say an author, I mean an author or a maker or composer or whatever, just a maker of something who makes a thing and then delivers it to an audience. And, through proscenium arts theatre and art galleries and publishing, that became quite a linear process, I think, for 300 or 400 years. And technology suggests ways in which that can be disrupted, so that kind of triangulation of the ancestral campfire is back with us. And that's the area that I've always been really interested in exploring.
And so I never thought about it in terms of the printing press being the, I just never thought about it in those terms, but of course that makes such sense. We talk about it a lot on this show, the storytelling, and that's part of, my listeners have heard it so often now, but the idea that, it's through telling our stories is the best way to connect with each other and the best way to find what we have in common, even if it seems at first that we have nothing in common. We do, but it's through telling stories, and that's so innate in us. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I couldn't agree more.
So specifically with People We Love, was there a specific inspiration for it for you? And when did you start working on it?
Yeah, well, as I say, I was interested in trying to make a participatory piece that wasn't driven by digital interactivity, which is what so much of my work before that had been. And weirdly, having just talked about the printing press, in one sense, one of the direct influences on it, on the thinking behind it, was Tristram Shandy, which, as you may know, is an 18th century English novel written by Laurence Sterne. And in it, there's a, I mean, the whole of the book is really, it's an exploration of what the novel can be and what a story can be. And it's very playful and full of disruptions in form and idea. But one of the things it does, or one of the things he does, is, I've forgotten which volume it is, but it's page 147 of, might be volume two, I'm not sure, but one of his characters is falling in love. And because he's kind of built this dialogue with his reader, Sterne, the author, so he's not, you know, the conceit of him telling a story is, again, it's very much like the campfire. He's very much talking directly to a reader. And so he sort of reaches out to the reader and says, well, look, you know, at this point, you have to believe that my character has fallen for the most desirable person imaginable, but I can't tell you who that would be for you. So I'm going to leave the next page blank. And that's the page for you to, he says paint, but I mean, you know, write, draw, express your idea of the most desirable person. And then the kind of, once you've done that, the story continues. Now, I don't think many people probably ever do scribble on the blank page in Tristram Shandy, but the idea is a really powerful one, partly in the sense that we've just talked about, that it reaches out to the reader as an active participant in the creative process.
I love that. Sorry.
Yeah, and partly because, you know, it's a request for the reader to engage their imagination in that creative process with a very open brief, you know, and and I think that's what was really behind the idea of People We Love. I wanted to come up with an idea that would frame imagination to a point where people could start an inquiry that had some framing around it, but at the same time was really open-ended. And I just thought the idea of looking into another human being's eyes, knowing only that they're looking at someone they love and nothing more, was a really interesting way of trying to do that, because I think it's impossible, I find it certainly impossible then not to to look into those eyes and wonder what the story is. You know, and a bit like, well, in a way, actually, I mean, it goes rather further than Sterne in the sense that, you know, for me as the author, I'm much more removed from the process than Sterne was, because here, you know, it's the imagination of somebody who sits to have their portrait made, which I know you've done. And in sitting for the portrait, you are asked to use your imagination to conjure up in your mind the reality of this image that is being projected in front of you of the person you love. And your imagination, in the sense, then meets the imagination of the viewer who comes into the gallery. And there's a kind of imaginative communion, I suppose, in which these two people, neither of whom I necessarily would have ever have met or know, make meaning and, I hope, beauty and story and all of the things that we've sort of talked about. So, yeah, that's a rather long-winded way of saying that was my inspiration.
After I sat for mine, I was able to go out and view some of the others. And it is incredible, that connection that you do feel with, and I love how you said it, you know, strangers, how if not for this, we probably would have never seen, you know, these faces or would meet these people. I think too, certain looks, like you're saying, we don't know who they're looking at, but there are certain looks on their faces, smiles or tears, whatever it is, or in their eyes, that I know for me that I connected with, even though I had no idea who the person was, but I recognized the look, or I recognized whatever emotion was in those eyes.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think, you know, it's actually very rare to be invited to stare into the eyes of another human being, because so often it's an act of hostility. And you know, we live in this incredibly visual culture where it's impossible to walk down the street without seeing images of faces plastered all over the place. And we do that in our private lives too, with Instagram and Facebook and whatever. And I, you know, most of those messages, sorry, most of those images have embedded messages, whether they're, you know, commercial ones driving sales, or whether they're just the things that we put on, as I say, put on Instagram. Because I think, you know, we don't on the whole take photographs of our child in tears when it's just fallen over and grazed its knee. It's not like we are recording our lives. We're always, in a sense, projecting something that we don't want the world to see about us.
Mm.
And I think what I find extraordinary about the faces of the portraits of people we love is that I think in the act of being filmed and imagining, they've almost forgotten that there's a lens in front of them. Mm. And the faces seem to be stripped of all this sort of self-consciousness and projection of a self and self-curation. And they're just incredibly vulnerable. And whether they're happy or sad or anywhere in between, I just find that empathic relationship with the eyes of another human being incredibly, I think the word I would use is consoling, you know. because I mean, life's difficult. It's difficult for all of us. And it has, you know, some extraordinarily beautiful moments, but it has some, you know, very dark moments too. And actually, the stories that lie behind all of those, the joy and the pain, is kind of expressed in all of us, I think. And so often, as I say, it's kind of curated away into something else. But when it's revealed, I find it really moving.
Mm. And I know I can, speaking for myself, I did lose myself into it and really wasn't aware, like you were saying, of being on camera or that there was a camera there. And so speaking, so along those lines, would you mind just explaining to our audience how the process works for participants and then how audience members are able to engage with it?
Yeah, of course. So the idea is, if you decide that you'd like to sit for people we love, is that you bring along a photograph. Most often it's on a photo on somebody's phone. But it could be a hard copy. And one of the premises behind the work is that that should be entirely private. So nobody need know who it is that you're looking at. We don't record that image, and we don't look at that image unless somebody asks us to. So the subject of a portrait then brings this image and they place it beside them in a little booth that we've made, which is kind of like a little photographic booth surrounded by black drapes with a light in it. And they sit, and then the image that they put down under a little camera by their side is projected onto what is essentially a teleprompter. So the image appears to hang in the darkness in front of your eyes as the subject. But in fact, is of course straight in front of the lens, which is how we get the eye contact to be so direct. And then we have a meditation, a kind of guided meditation, which is about 7 minutes long. Found this rather wonderful Scottish voice artist who has, I think, the most beautiful voice.
Oh, I totally agree. Sorry, I totally agree.
I think that was really important because there's a gentleness and a sympathetic kind of quality to her voice. But mm-hmm. at the same time, there's a kind of steeliness that stops it from feeling, at least to me, feeling kind of saccharine. I'm very pleased we found her. And the first 4 minutes probably of this, or three and a half certainly, of the 7 minute guided meditation is really just her settling you down. And she asks the participant to close their eyes. And I think this is all part of a process, not only of relaxing the participants, but also, say, sort of getting them into a place where actually by the time the filming starts for real, they've kind of forgotten, not in a tricked sense, but just in a kind of self-conscious sense, that they're being filmed. And so after about 3 minutes, she asks the participants to open their eyes and then asks a series of really open-ended questions. Because obviously, we don't know, as I say, who people are looking at, and they could bring a picture of, you know, anything. But the premise is that it's a person. But, you know, we obviously were aware that some people would want to look at people, pictures of people who they'd lost. Other people might be looking at a picture of somebody they'd only just met. And yeah. So there was a kind of massive range of possibility in terms of age and relationship that we were wanting to cover. So we tried to make these questions as open-ended as possible. And then at the end of it, we asked them to take away their photograph and to leave the booth. And we normally have a kind of brief chat with people afterwards. I've always been very keen to ask people really whether they feel that in any way we've taken advantage of them, I suppose, because certainly in quite a few cases, people come out profoundly moved. And, you know, it's quite an odd thing to feel responsible for that.
That right.
people go in dry-eyed and cheerful and come out often, you know, sobbing. But actually, in all the times we've done it, and we've done it in York and Pittsburgh now, and well over 300 people, we haven't had anybody who said, no, I feel uncomfortable about it. I think most people say that they find it very cathartic, you know, even those who are most profoundly upset by the experience. So that's really it from a filming point of view. And then from all I do with that as a kind of, as the artist, if you like, is top and tail the video, because obviously we in order to leave people alone, we start filming right from the beginning of the meditation. So I kind of cut it from the moment people open their eyes to the moment that filming section finishes, and do a slight kind of color grade on it, which is really just equivalent to putting a photo filter on just to make sure it looks as good as it can. But other than that, I tried not to curate anything. The only reason we haven't sometimes used people is for technical reasons. I certainly never tried to make a distinction about the faces that should get used and the faces that shouldn't, which actually leads me on to maybe something that I kind of find really interesting about my own relationship to the piece, in that when I first started doing it, I was, I suppose, like a small child collecting butterflies, you know, that kind of, I'd get excited by people who were demonstrably emotive. You'd kind of go, oh, you know, this is great because it's so powerful. And over time, as I've lived with the piece, I've completely changed my perspective on that. I mean, not to say that those people who are profoundly moved and visibly so are not massively interesting to look at and engaging. But actually, sometimes the really stoical faces, the really slow faces are even more or just as interesting, because it is very much slow art, really. And if you know, you can walk past these portraits in a minute or two and look at them and just go, yeah, I get it. People staring at people they love. But to really feel it, you have to stand right in front of one of these portraits for the duration of each one. And they're about, as I say, about 3 minutes each when they're edited. And then I think I haven't yet found a single face that isn't fascinating to watch and that doesn't reveal all sorts of hidden stories. They're not so much hidden stories as imagined stories, but stories that one can project onto them.
So are there any, and I realize this is a big question, like you said, at least you've had 300 participants at least so far. Are there any particular moments or images or people that have stuck with you that you'd like to share with us, or could, I don't know.
I mean, so many really, again, yeah. So many. I think one of the things that I mean, which isn't really completely answering your question, it's like slightly, but I do find that when I've spent time with these portraits, that I walk out into the street and see faces walking towards me. And I'm far more interested in them and the stories that they reveal than I am at any other time. And I think I'm pleased about that, that it, the perceptive or the change of perception that the piece suddenly evokes in me, you know, does, I think, make me feel like a more empathic human being. And to get slightly closer to your question, but not still not quite answer it. I think the other thing that's very interesting is that when you take the, for example, the Pittsburgh faces together, they speak incredibly of time and place in quite a specific sense. You know, and I would love, I mean, God willing, I'd love to look at those faces again in 20 or 30 years time, because I just think as a document of a time and place, it's a really beautiful kind of congregation. But when you look at any one face, you get universality. That's what's so interesting. The specificity, struggling over the word, is really about the group. However diverse that group is, and the Pittsburgh group is fantastically diverse. But, you know, it is Pittsburgh, and it can't really be anywhere other than Pittsburgh. But but each face just, to me, speaks of a kind of universal humanity, which I love. And then in terms of story, I mean, I suppose so, but I don't know, I feel a bit protective of them, really, because of the sort of anonymity of the work and the fact that, you know, it's not really an exercise in forensics or forensic psychology, you know, as in what's the truth behind the face. I'm intrigued by the stories that people project. And one of the things that I have found really interesting is, and Renee Pajczoki, who's the producer of the work here in Pittsburgh, has found too, is that there are a couple of faces where we both kind of categorically went, well, they've clearly lost somebody and that's why they're reacting so profoundly. Sometimes found out that the story is completely the opposite, and that it's a very joyful experience, but that is evoking a kind of, you know, almost tortured looking face. And I think that's very interesting in a way, that, you know, emotion, when it's felt profoundly, it's very hard sometimes to read a distinction between the profoundly tragic and the profoundly joyful, which, you know, which is kind of beautiful. And I think the other thing that, you know, that is so beautiful is how much we all clearly do carry with us and feel, and how much consolation one can, as I said earlier, get from looking, or at least I feel like one can get from looking into the faces, these honest, open faces that invite you to stare at them.
It's such a beautiful gift that you've curated, maybe. Could that be a word too?
Curated.
I don't know. But it's just, it is. And it's, you know, for, like we're saying, it's humanity. It's finding, we're finding these ways to connect with each other. And okay, talking about Pittsburgh, as you said, the Pittsburgh group here. So Pittsburgh is the site of the North American premiere of this. How did that come to be? How was Pittsburgh chosen or selected?
Well, Pittsburgh has a kind of special place in my heart, really, in that one of the previous works that I made under the name, you know, the name of KMA with a colleague called Tom Wexler, we made a big interactive audiovisual piece that was in Market Square in 2014 for, I think, 4 weeks. And it was the inaugural commission by the Pittsburgh Downtown Partnership. And it's a piece that we had done in other places around the world with success. But there was something really joyful about the way it was performed in Pittsburgh and the way that the people of Pittsburgh took to the piece and the way it sat within the environment here. And so I think we all had a really positive experience from that. And so when I was thinking about trying to get this piece of work out, and obviously, you know, post-COVID, everything's been tricky. I reached out to Renee, who had also been the producer of Congregation, and told her about the work that I was making. And she took it to the Pittsburgh Downtown Partnership, and together they agreed that they would like to bring it to Pittsburgh. And I'm just so happy they did, because, you know, not only is it wonderful to get the piece to North America, but as I said, Pittsburgh does really feel like it's a kind of special place for me, and I'm delighted.
And so would you like to give us the specifics on the dates, how long and where folks can go to check it out?
Yeah, let me. So it's in a kind of pop-up gallery on 320 Smithfield, which I think was, most people seem to know, as the old liquor store.
That's how I knew it. I got to be honest. Well, at one Oxford Center.
I have to say, if I was a resident of Pittsburgh, that's how I would know it.
But also a Pittsburgh thing. I don't know if you've heard this, but a very Pittsburgh thing is to talk about places and what they used to be. Or like, if you give directions, you'll be like, turn left where the liquor store used to be. And then, so it's no help if you've never been there, or you never knew something was there, because we tend to think that things is what they were originally.
Well, all sorts of puns about the spirit of Pittsburgh would survive. But so that's where it is. It's in the old liquor store. It runs from, it's open now, and it runs until June the 5th. It's open Wednesday through Saturday, 12 till 8 p.m. and mm-hmm. Sundays from 1 till 5 p.m. So closed Monday and Tuesday. Mm-hmm. And then if people want to participate and be filmed, we do still have two more filming days on April 30th and May the 8th. And people can register their interest in doing that via email, which is pittsburgh@peoplewelove.online.
So wonderful. I just appreciate getting this chance to talk more with you and learn more about how this all started and where. So it's here till June 5th. And then where else might it be after that?
Yeah, we're looking at the moment of trying to get it into other places across the world, really. I mean, I think that there's something interesting about that relationship between the specifics of time and place and the universality of human faces. And of course, it's completely, well, it's an almost completely wordless experience. I mean, as you know, having sat for it, there are, mm-hmm. you're prompted by a voiceover. But from the viewer's perspective, it's an entirely wordless experience. So it's completely translatable. As soon as you have more and more communities, then I think the universality of it becomes even stronger. Because you can, and one of the things we're doing in Pittsburgh that we also did in New York. So when we ran the piece in York Minster, which is obviously a very different environment to the liquor store. But actually, I mean, in many ways, the liquor store feels closer to my heart, and not necessarily for the obvious ones. But I think what I love about it is that it faces out into the street. And obviously the Minster, you had to go in to this extraordinary kind of cathedral in order to see the work. And there's a lot of people, you know, who would never do that. Just as a lot of people would never go into an art gallery, let alone, you know, even one that's as kind of informal and pop-up as mm-hmm. the one on 320 Smithfield Street. And yet I kind of wanted, you know, the work to speak to as many people as possible. And so I kind of like the idea that it runs 24/7. I should have said that. So even when the gallery is closed, you know, these seven screens stare out all through the night with the same compassionate faces. And I kind of hope that, you know, maybe somebody at 3 a.m. feeling like the world's abandoned them can stop and just get some solace from these faces staring back.
Mm.
So yes, that's again a slightly kind of digressive answer to your question of where next.
No, I mean, that's good.
Where specifically next, I don't know, but certainly the intention is to try to, as I say, build a body of places from around the world.
Well, thank you so much for what, not just for what you're doing, but for your time today and for, I'm going to keep track of KMA and hopefully you'll come back to the Berg.
Oh, I hope so. I do hope so. Yeah, well, thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure. It was a pleasure to meet you yesterday and thank you for participating and great to be able to talk to you now.
Here we are. Welcome to Where in the U.S. is Don DiGiulio? So here's how it's going to work. As I mentioned before, Don is in a city. Okay, so you know, I'll give you that. It's not a small town. It is a city somewhere in the contiguous United States. And I have 8 statements of fact. An interesting number, I know. And I'm going to read them one by one. I'll pause for a few seconds in between. And if you know the answer, email us at yinsaregood@gmail.com with your answer. And the first 3 correct answers that we receive are going to get some yag swag. Yeah, it still sounds bad. So, you know what to do. yinsaregood@gmail.com. And we will get back to you either way. And if you are one of the first 3, we'll get back to you and ask for your contact info to get the goods out to you. Are you ready, Yinzers? Here we go. Number 1. This city's Jefferson Memorial Park is the largest municipal urban forest in the United States, sitting on over 6,000 acres of land. Number 2. This city is the disco ball capital of the world. 90% of the disco balls in the U.S. are produced here. This city's famous Seelbach Hotel served as the inspiration for F. Scott Fitzgerald's novel, The Great Gatsby, which was published in 1925. Number 4. The Old Fashioned is this city's official cocktail. Number 5. This city is the hometown of Muhammad Ali, Diane Sawyer, Jennifer Lawrence, and Hunter S. Thompson. Number 6. This city, which sits along the Ohio River, is home to the oldest Mississippi-style steamboat in existence. This steamboat will turn 108 years old this year. Number 7. Joseph E. Seagram and Sons opened the world's largest distillery in this city following the repeal of Prohibition. And number 8. This city is a leading producer of bonded bourbon whiskey. There you have it, folks. So, if you think you know the answer to where in the U.S. is Don DiGiulio, email us and we'll chat more about the results next week. I cannot wait to receive your responses. Where is Don DiGiulio? And with that, we will be bringing this episode number 52 to a close. I am your host, Tressa Glover. Again, thank you so much for tuning in. And again, a huge thank you to Kit Monkman. And folks, please do head down to One Oxford Center there at 320 Smithfield Street to catch a glimpse, to experience people we love. And I would love to hear your thoughts and your feedback about your experience as well. And as Kit mentioned, this will be, well, tomorrow, so when this episode drops, April 30th is an opportunity if you want to participate. And then again, May 8th, and that is Mother's Day. That might be an interesting experience to go with perhaps your mother or your mom figure or your children, you know, maybe go and you could each have the experience. Just a thought. I hope you have a great week ahead. And until next time, my friends, be safe, be kind, be good. Special thanks to Renee Pichocki, Jason Eldridge, and as always, for our most fabulous artwork, Mike Rubino.